From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Singapore mourns the death of the man who turned that country into a global hub.
But first, Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz is in the race for the White House 2016.
I believe in the power of millions of courageous conservatives rising up to reignite the promise of America. And that is why today I am announcing that I'm running for president of the United States.
Senator Cruz this morning at Liberty University in Virginia. Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent, joins us to talk about this. And Ron, we're still, we should say, 19 months away from the elections, although he's the first one to get in officially. What is the strategy here?
The strategy is marketing, message, and money. Jeremy, three M's. First of all, in terms of marketing, this is getting to be a very crowded category, the would-be fresh faces of the Republican field for 2016. There are some 20 names being bandied about at this point. Seriously, 20 different names. Yeah. So if we're looking for a fresh face, Ted Cruz says, how about my relatively fresh face? How about focusing on me right now? And he gets that by coming out not just with an exploratory committee, but with a full-fledged candidacy. Then he's also getting his message out, the idealism of the conservative, if you will. He used the word believe. He used the word imagine very frequently in this speech this morning. And finally, it's a chance to raise money when nobody else is a full-fledged candidate, and he is. And he needs something like $50 million. That's $50 million to be competitive with Jeb Bush.
Wow. And he spoke this morning at Liberty University, as we said, in Virginia. He talked about repealing Obamacare. He talked about establishing a flat tax and abolishing the IRS. He talked about an assault on religious liberty at that religious university. Who is the base for Senator Cruz in this field, and would they be able to carry him through to get the nomination at the very least?
That's a great question, and exactly what he is trying to determine at this point. He doesn't have a base yet. He's in single digits in national polls among Republicans. So the idea is to build a base, and he's bidding for two groups, really. The Tea Party people, who were largely his supporters in 2010 in Texas when he was first elected to the Senate, and then also for religious conservatives, sometimes called evangelicals. But there are lots of different kinds of conservative people who are very religious and for whom religion, more God in government, is really the essential challenge.
Now, he's already been attacked even before he got in, Ron. Yesterday on Meet the Press, California Governor Jerry Brown was on, and he was played a clip of Ted Cruz on Late Night with Seth Meyers, where Meyers asked Cruz about climate change, and Cruz said global warming alarmists have a problem because science doesn't back them up. Jerry Brown, who was on there to talk about the drought, said this on Meet the Press.
That man betokens such a level of ignorance and a direct falsification of the existing scientific data. It's shocking, and I think that man has rendered himself absolutely unfit to be running for office.
Wow, some strong comments there from Jerry Brown.
Yes. Tell us how you really feel, Governor.
I also think that was the first time betokens has ever been used on Meet the Press, but I don't know.
Jerry Brown is someone who is free because no one is expecting him to run for president. He's about 9 years, almost a decade older than Hillary Clinton. No one is expecting him to get into the actual race. So he is free to really level the guns against a Ted Cruz or someone else who essentially takes the viewpoint of denying the consensus of scientists on global warming or climate change, whatever you want to call it, and problems that are quite real in California, where they are in a serious drought. So people are really focused on it in that state and many other parts of the country, too, including the Northeast, which has just had a pretty awful winter.
Yes, indeed. We can attest to that from personal experience. And Ron, what about the Democratic side? Jerry Brown did say he was not going to run in 2016. But is Hillary Clinton going to face somebody who wants to do what Ted Cruz is doing today and say, I'm going to get out in front of the pack and I'm going to announce right now?
Yes, I think there will probably be a challenger from the left for Hillary Clinton, but I don't expect that person to emerge terribly soon. Elizabeth Warren has made it clear she does not want to be that person. I don't believe that independent Bernie Sanders from Vermont, while he may run, would really be a full-fledged candidate. So it's not clear who that standard bearer will be, and it is clear that Hillary Clinton is going to declare for president next month. So the left is still looking for a champion.
Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent, as Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, gets into the race officially for 2016. Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, to Singapore now. In 1965, fewer than 2 million people lived there, and the island state was known as little more than the site of a major World War II battle. Now, Singapore's population has more than doubled. It's still small, 5 million people, but that makes it all the more remarkable that it is the world's fourth biggest economic center, and that growth has been attributed to one man, Lee Kuan Yew. The 91-year-old died today at Singapore General Hospital. He was the first prime minister, the man who shaped the country 50 years ago, after independence from Britain. President Obama described him as a giant of history. In Singapore, state TV broke away from regular programming, and Lee's son, the current prime minister, struggled through an emotional tribute. The BBC's Jonathan Head is outside the presidential palace in Singapore. Jonathan, what's going on there?
Very large numbers have come down here. They're lining up as I speak, and it's well into the night now in Singapore, and the lines are still there of people who want to write messages of condolence on cards that have been laid out for them. It's a very orderly process of commemoration, as you would expect in this most orderly of Asian cities. This is an incredibly important moment, perhaps the most important one for the citizens of this island state since it became independent back in 1965. This man has really towered over Singapore throughout that time. Prime Minister for 31 years, even before formal independence, and then occupying senior positions since then.
Well, as you've been reporting, he created this highly educated workforce that could speak fluent English, reached out to foreign investors, tackled corruption, tried to clear slums. But he also was ruthless in many ways, and he said that. He said he interfered in the private lives of citizens. Tell us more about that, sort of the iron rule.
Yes, he always said you have to have some iron in you to rule Singapore. The experience of living under Japanese occupation during the Second World War, when he was very nearly executed at one point, seeing how harsh the Japanese were, but how effectively they maintained order. Then going to Britain for his education and seeing what he should aspire to, a proper legal system, a proper political system, made him very aware of the realities of Southeast Asia and what an uphill task it would be to turn these developing societies, and in Singapore's case, a multiracial society, into a viable and orderly state. And that drove him to assume the worst of people. He said people here could not afford the luxury of liberal individualism that you see in the West, that they had to be treated to severe and harsh leadership. I think by and large here, people accepted that. There were many who didn't, and of course, the voices of dissent have been very effectively silenced here. Mr. Lee very successfully used the Singapore courts to sue any papers who criticized him. He jailed a lot of his opponents. And by and large, when you see the extraordinary success he's made of Singapore, I think he felt his arguments were justified.
Low crime, little corruption, people relatively well off. But he, you know, when we talk about the iron rule, he banned chewing gum. And for a while, the government, as you report, was into matchmaking to create smarter babies.
Yes, I mean, it's the ultimate nanny state, really, Singapore. There are constant worries about whether Singaporeans are good enough at innovation, for example, thinking outside the box. There are extraordinary things about Singapore. It's not really a model because there's nothing else like this. It has no hinterland. It is just a city, albeit in a very viable position for trading. It's helped make it successful. And there's no one else like Lee Kuan Yew. In some ways, he's not that Asian. He's not like the other charismatic leaders we've seen in this region who were prone to flights of fancy, were very egotistical, often made terrible misjudgments. Lee Kuan Yew was a ruthless pragmatist. He had no religious beliefs. He was not interested in ideology. He started in the 1950s when he was campaigning for independence in alliance with communists, very quickly saw that that was a dead end, became fanatically anti-communist, but he would deal with anybody who could help his country survive. And that incredible, clear-sighted, ruthless pragmatism was admired by many people. He was a great intellectual ally of Henry Kissinger, for example. His advice on dealing with the powers in this region was sought by everybody.
Well, you report Singapore has recently become more socially liberal. Some of the political opposition made some gains. It's a very tiny political opposition, but made some gains in the last elections. And it has this huge economic engine. What do you see happening in the future, just briefly?
There's no question the machine that Lee Kuan Yew built, a super efficient, super honest government, very elite, very well paid civil servants, super educated, will continue. But I think psychologically, his death is going to have an impact. And remember, there's a lot more resentment now in Singapore about the incredible cost of living. This is now one of the most expensive cities on earth. And although the government provides a great deal in terms of infrastructure, many more moderately paid Singaporeans are feeling left out. They feel it's given itself over to the financial businesses that have helped it be so successful. So I think in time, we will start to see more dissent. And the kind of iron rule that Lee Kuan Yew was able to impose in the early days of development in the Cold War will no longer be sustainable here.
That's the BBC's Jonathan Head outside the presidential palace in Singapore, commenting on the death of the 91-year-old founder of that country, Lee Kuan Yew. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
For generations, most of the women in Alice Randall's African-American family weighed more than 200 pounds. And as she wrote in an op-ed in the New York Times, like many black women, they are heavy because they want to be. Their men find it sexy. Their children cherish comfortable laps. Well, that's changed for Alice. With her daughter Caroline, she's written a new cookbook that's part family memoir and a warning. It also graphically ties black women and food and weight to a terrible history of slavery. The book is called Soul Food Love, Healthy Recipes Inspired by 100 Years of Cooking in a Black Family. And Alice Randall joins us from Vanderbilt University, where she's a writer in residence. Welcome.
It's so great to be with you today, Robin.
And Caroline Randall-Williams joins us from Vanderbilt as well, even though you are both Harvard grads. Caroline, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here with you.
And tell us more about this family history and this cultural thinking. I mean, Alice, you write that when you were a young girl, you prayed for fat thighs.
Well, kitchens and farms have been very difficult spaces for black people in general and black women in particular. It's led us to a situation when one out of every four middle-aged black women has diabetes. Four out of five black women are overweight.
And Caroline, by the way, we should point out you did not have the weight problem. Your mother came to you to help change hers. But had you heard about this history about African-American women working in kitchens for others but not permitted to eat with them?
Of course. You know, I think something like 90% of black women who were employed at the turn of the 20th century were employed as either domestic servants or they worked in fields and on farms. So I was conscious of, you know, sort of the strange dynamics of kitchen culture in terms of women who cooked for other women's families but didn't get to cook for themselves because those women were the women that I come from.
Well, and Alice, this has to be one of the most powerful cookbooks ever because this history is laced throughout. You talk about something called kitchen rape. Tell us more about that.
Kitchen rape is something that hasn't been discussed enough in America and its role in the obesity epidemic. Many, many black children were conceived in rapes that domestic servants experience when working.
Yeah. Caroline, your great-grandmother, Alberta, her grandmother continued to cook and clean for a family whose son raped their daughter. Her mother, your great-grandmother's mother, went crazy after she was raped?
That is true. I mean, it's a total. And what's amazing about it is that Alberta, for all of that strife, was actually very adept in her own kitchen. And she actually used the kitchen to fight back against cultural oppression by hosting these elaborate black women's club parties from her kitchen back when upper middle class black people still weren't welcome in restaurants that white people frequented. She said, okay, I'm going to cook these beautiful meals in my home and not allow whatever is going on in the outside world to mean that me and my friends can't enjoy this food.
Or to mean that we are less than human.
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
She used her pots and pans to create occasional meals that underscored the humanity of the people eating and the people cooking.
Yeah. What was some of the food?
Oh, she was known for her shrimp creoles, so many different foods.
Oh, God, and layer cakes. I mean, beautiful. We're talking beautiful layer cakes that people don't even have the time, energy, or skill to prepare in their homes anymore.
But also in the Middle Passage, we have stories that are handed down of women who actually would hide sesame seeds in their hair on their person. So the point is that women were giving comfort to their children with healthy foods, including the plain baked sweet potato, the roasted fish. It's not just those layer cakes. We were not baking layer cakes in the slavery period. But all of that leads to problems with weight. And in our cookbook, we revive a lot of traditional soul foods. But on a few occasions, we translate something, such as Grandma Bonton's layer cake, into a crepe stack cake that is far healthier. Instead of cups of sugar, it has tablespoons.
Just to leap in, one of the things that's most important to us is that we're not trying to tell people to get thin. We're trying to tell people to get healthy, and bigness can be healthy. I think losing 10% of your body weight, so if you're 200 pounds, losing 20 pounds, getting down just to 180 drastically reduces your chances of getting diabetes. So we said, lose 20 pounds. You don't have to lose 100.
Well, because Alice, as you point out, and again in this essay in the New York Times, part of the reason you tell us that many Black women had, you know, almost embraced size is that it was a political statement. It was political resistance.
I was fat to some degree because I wanted to be. I looked around at all the large women in my family, and I wanted to be like those women. But there is a lot of complexity. How do you feel about farms when people are lynched in rural America? How do you feel about kitchens when your family members have been raped in a kitchen? Mm. There has been a breaking with the farm and the kitchen that was reasonable. And largeness could be a transgressive act. When you are owned by someone else, your fitness was something that validated that person's worth and actually influenced their economic future. And so they become transgressive acts of self-injury. But those become complex and they are still self-injury. I do recall praying for large thighs. I remember there was a wonderful old soul song, "Some Man Somewhere is Going to Love You Skinny Legs and All." The idea of being thin not being the dominant aesthetic. And so, yes, there is that part of it. And I also go with the notion that something that 4 out of every 5 Black women is doing cannot be completely something none of us want to do. But we have to take apart that wanting and figure out what we want something new now.
Right. It's a phenomenal—I mean, I can't encourage people enough to read the history that's wrapped around the recipes. It's just fascinating. The book is called Soul Food Love. It's written by Alice Randall and her daughter, Caroline Randall Williams, who join us. And they say that something has to change about the African-American diet. So let's just talk about some of the recipes that can help people do that. I mean, chicken roasted with lemon and onion.
It was the very first home-cooked meal I made when I moved to the Mississippi Delta. And I remember, you know, I was raised in rarefied grocery stores and farmers markets. And then I moved to Mississippi and I went into the local grocery store and I saw my little roaster chicken and I grabbed a bag of onions and a bag of lemons. And I said, I can roast this chicken, which is something that I was raised to do. I'd seen done in both my grandmother and great-grandmother's home. But it was one of my absolute favorite things. And my friends request it frequently.
Well, it is not what people have traditionally eaten in the Delta. It's not fried chicken. And you call fried chicken a bad boyfriend. Time to kick him out.
It is time to kick him out. And roasted chicken is the good boyfriend that you can take home to your mama to help her, you know, open parentheses, to help her lose weight, close parentheses.
Fried chicken has not always been an African-American foodways. It is also truly associated with domestic servitude and what people had in sharecropping cabins and small places, often a quiet fire, and would make lots of roasted food and stews, because standing by the stove to fry something requires a lot of immediate attention that often people who are laboring don't have.
Well, take us through New School Fruit Salad.
New School Fruit Salad is one of my absolute favorite ones because I also think it's fun and educational. I have a background as an elementary school teacher, and I remember telling my students that tomatoes and avocados were fruit and the astonishment on their faces at this revelation, for example. And then we have the watermelon, which is a classic fruit favorite. It was important for us to include the watermelon for a number of reasons. One, because it's delicious. Two, because we want to reclaim it and divorce it from negative stereotypes about Black food ways.
You tell us some African Americans will not eat watermelon because it had such stigma.
Absolutely. I think, and that is a sad, hard truth. And they certainly, I know personally Black people who will not eat watermelon in front of white people because they don't want to confirm any preconceptions or stereotypes.
You know, in the 19th century, there were horrible caricatures that were drawn and appeared in papers and magazines that use the slice of watermelon to look like a gaping Black grin. And this was an image that was used against African Americans to argue for our lack of humanity.
Well, and you write about another. Warning, it's very derogatory, but you say people make a casual reference to chicken as coon food.
They forget that the word coon comes from the phrase raccoon of Black people as chicken thieves, and they don't know how they can be inadvertently insulting Black people or putting salt in wounds that they have forgotten. The same way when they think of fruit, they don't think of the lynching tree and the phrase strange fruit. But for African Americans, older African Americans, we think of rural acres as very dangerous places, not necessarily pastoral spaces.
Right. Well, you mentioned, Alice, that part of your weight issue when you were growing up was that you loved the women in your family so much and wanted to be like them. And here you have this loving relationship with a daughter that is still around food, but in a different way. Talk about, for instance, your pear, your jugged pear recipe.
The jugged pear is a recipe that involves peeling pears, in our case, hundreds of them, and cooking them in a bath of herbs and spices and wine that's slightly sweetened and slow cooking them on the stove. That's a recipe where Caroline and I have shared some of our biggest secrets, but it's also a dessert recipe that has no added fat to it. And it's just a wonderful celebrating of spending time together in the creation of the food, not just the cooking of the food. And the jugged pear is something that we truly love.
Yeah. Well, and you're cooking just like grandmothers and great-grandmothers did before, you know, in back rooms behind closed doors.
Exactly. Yeah.
But way out in the open in this terrific new book. It's called Soul Food Love, Healthy Recipes Inspired by 100 Years of Cooking in a Black Family. Alice Randall, her daughter Caroline Randall Williams, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Some rare comments over the weekend from a top Chinese official. China's top weather scientist says climate change could have a huge impact on the country's agriculture and infrastructure. He made the comments to China's Xinhua news agency, saying climate change could lead to ecological degradation and pose a serious threat to a number of massive Chinese infrastructure projects. And we remember that China is the world's largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. Ali Velshi is host of Real Money on Al Jazeera America. He's with us from San Francisco to talk about this. Ali, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks, Jeremy. Good to be here.
Well, does this signal a new direction on the part of Beijing to be coming out so forcefully and talking about climate change like this? This is not something that the Chinese government has traditionally done.
No, this is interesting because China has been aware of its pollution problem. First of all, everybody in China is aware of it. In major cities in China, you have only to visit or live there to understand that there are these large particles in the air, heavy smog, some of the highest pollution levels exist anywhere. China knows it's got a problem, and it's actually been working actively to try to solve it. What it doesn't like to do is encourage dissent through discussions of pollution. So, in fact, there was a very, very popular documentary recently that it pulled from the internet because it was becoming too popular. It's very, very unusual to hear a Chinese government official make on-the-record comments about the damaging effects of pollution to the economy. But within government circles, they do have a pretty good understanding of the magnitude of the problem that they have in terms of pollution generation.
Well, how do you square that then? How do you have, on the one hand, they're saying we're not going to allow this documentary to run, and on the other hand, we're going to come out and say this is a real problem?
I think China doesn't really have a good policy on understanding how to let these things play out in the public. Everybody in China is aware that pollution is a massive problem. In fact, this particular documentary called Under the Dome, it was quite remarkable. It is quite remarkable. It was so popular in China, that seems to be what caused the Chinese to pull it back. But at the same time, they don't want to be seen as not addressing the issue. They have been criticized for not dealing full on with the issue that they generate half of the world's carbon emissions. They use half of the world's coal, and about two-thirds of all energy in China is produced by coal, which in 2015 remains one of the dirtiest ways to produce electricity. So China wants to be seen to be doing some things. This official who came out to speak was a sort of a chief meteorologist, so he's not the most high-ranking official, but those were public comments where he said, if we don't get a handle on this, it will affect agriculture, it will affect infrastructure, and it'll affect the economy.
And that's where I want to go next. How does the economy play into all this? Because China's economy has been slowing down to some degree in recent months, in recent years. That's obviously going to affect how much coal is being burned and how much energy is being used.
So a slowing economy affects the ability to control pollution two ways. One is, in a slowing economy in China, one of the most direct results is that they use less electricity. As a result of using less electricity, they will use less coal. The other issue, of course, is in a slowing economy, more expensive clean technologies are less enticing. So China has not come out with firm rules and regulations, and they're going to need to pretty soon.
Ali Velshi, host of Real Money on Al Jazeera America, with the latest on this rare comments from a top Chinese official over the weekend. Ali, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Today, President Obama announced more than $240 million in pledges from the private sector to get more students interested in studying science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM for short. The president also issued a challenge to Congress to beef up funding for science.
So it's not enough for us to just lift up young people and say, great job, way to go. You also have to have labs to go to, and you've got to be able to support yourself while you're doing this amazing research. And that involves us as a society making the kind of investments that are going to be necessary for us to continue to innovate for many, many years to come.
President Obama speaking today at the White House Science Fair, where more than 35 student teams are exhibiting their science projects. Meanwhile, high school seniors across the country today may be constantly refreshing their email or rushing to get the mail when it arrives because they are getting responses from the colleges they've applied to, finding out if they got in to their dream schools or not. It's the end of a long process that starts when they're sophomores and take the preliminary SAT or PSAT, a test that is about to change. Lisa Maselli is director of college counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, Illinois, my high school. She joins us from WILL to tell us more. Lisa, welcome back.
Thank you, Jeremy. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, let's talk about the changes coming to the PSAT. What kinds of changes?
You know, the PSAT is going to be brand new this October 2015, which is going to be the launch of a full-length test for the students to see what the redesigned SAT will eventually look like in March. So it's going to have two sections. It's going to be math and evidence-based reading and writing. It's going to be scored 200 and 800 on both of those sections with a maximum score of 1600, which is going to be aligned with how the SAT is going to be rescored in March back to 1600. There's still going to be no essay. So the juniors in October don't have to worry about writing an essay. There's nothing like that on the exam. But it is getting longer. There's 2 hours and 45 minutes now versus 2 hours and 10 minutes. And calculators aren't going to be required on all parts of the exam, things like that. I would be encouraging sophomores and their parents right now to go to the College Board website. It's deliveringopportunity.org. And that site has everything. It has what did PSAT look like before? What does it look like now? So I would always say go right to the source. College Board is the place to go right now.
Well, and we'll link to that at our website, hereandnow.org. But why are they doing this? Why are they making these changes?
The word relevance keeps coming up. We want everything to be more relevant to a high school student. We want it to be aligned with the curriculum. We want students to realize that the best preparation for these exams, instead of thinking about how to strategize and beat tests, is to take a rigorous curriculum. So I do think the College Board is trying to say, look, to prepare for these, take a rigorous curriculum and make sure that you use all of our resources and you go online and take advantage of all these ways to prepare that aren't really going to cost kids money anymore. I would say as soon as high school counselors, or even if they go to College Board and find this on their own, as soon as these PDFs are going to be released to us, which is supposed to be a full-length practice test for the PSAT, those are things that the class of 2017 should be taking advantage of. There's nothing better you can do than to actually take full-length exams and time yourself, pace yourself, and realize that, you know, you've got to go through it to actually understand the stamina you need and how to actually go through all the sections. A change that's going to be happening is that they're not going to be penalizing students for guessing anymore. So you used to actually have points subtracted from your score for wrong answers. That's actually not going to be the case. So I do think one thing that I'll be talking with my families about is while now you don't have that pressure that you're losing points if your answer is wrong, I don't want kids to rely on that too much and almost just not go deep and focus, knowing they can rely on just filling in the bubbles. Because I do think sometimes when that pressure is off you, you sometimes might, you know, get a little bit too easy on it. And I do think that the elimination of those points is going to be helpful to kids, but I still want them to focus and take every question as seriously as they can.
Now, you say that this is happening ahead of changes to the SAT, and I wonder, why is the SAT changing yet again? They recently went from 1,600 as the top score up to 2,400. Now it's changing again.
Yeah. 2005 was the last change that the SAT saw. And we could go on and on about whether or not these scores are actually doing what they're intended to do. But I do think that the College Board is trying to help align it with curriculum and say, let's think about what you're learning in the high school. Let's make it more relevant to you. Let's have things less obscure and more relevancy so that you feel like a rigorous curriculum is really the solid preparation that you need to do well on these exams.
How many practice tests would you recommend people take before they take the real thing?
You know, I kind of fall in the camp where I don't know if I like students practicing and practicing and worrying about these exams for months and months and months. Sometimes when you look at a testing schedule and you're mapping out when you want to test, maybe going back 2 months and thinking, what can I do in a consistent pattern so that my full effort is going to be consistent? I think about my treadmill sitting in my room. I bought a treadmill, Jeremy. I'm not putting in the effort. I'm not, you know, going to get healthy if I don't put in all the time I need to do it. So I feel like when it comes to test preparation, you have to make sure that the effort's there, the consistency is there, and that you actually realize that you have a goal in mind, and that kind of keeps you motivated.
Okay, I want to go from the class of 2017 to the class of 2015, who are finding out right now whether they get into the colleges that they have applied to. What would be your advice right now to them and their families as they go through that process?
These college outcomes do not define how wonderful these kids are, because the way that the admissions landscape is today, we have kids that are waiting for outcomes, and oftentimes if they don't get into where they really wanted to go, they just kind of feel destroyed. I often feel like I'm a rescue counselor in the spring semester. And what I think parents need to do is start the tone right now, even before these outcomes come. Start telling your child, I love you unconditionally. It doesn't matter where you go. I'll wear any sweatshirt. I'll put any bumper sticker on my car. Because where you go doesn't define who you are. It doesn't define your future success. It definitely doesn't define how much money you're going to make. So I think setting that tone before they even come out is so important, because the outcomes are hard. I mean, there are kids that are going to be celebrating. There are kids that are going to feel very disappointed, and some of them will even feel destroyed. We often have to remind them their future is not defined by one college.
But it might be easier said than done in a way that they're still going to feel, whether they get in or don't get into the colleges of their choice,
absolutely,
that it does matter to their future.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think that's where I often just like to remind students, I'm like, look, let's really think about this. You know, where did someone maybe that they have in their life who's a role model go to school? Or maybe even talking with where some of their family members went to school. I think sometimes right now we have such an obsession over a small list of schools that if you really think of who's in your life, who you really love, look up to, maybe even admire. I think about our own faculty at Uni High where I work. Our students adore our faculty. We don't have an entire faculty that went to Ivy League schools, and our kids absolutely adore them and admire them and, you know, work with them. So I always try to help students remember, I know it hurts. I'm going to validate that, and I'm right there with you. I even tell students I would love to send a sympathy card to that college because I know they lost a fabulous student. Seriously, I could, like, invest in a stack of those in my office because I do think, Jeremy, it's hard. I understand it. Everyone has that disappointment. But we have to remind them, when they built that college list, you know, let's remind you why those schools were on your list in the first place and get you excited so that when you go off to orientation, you're there in the moment. You're growing where you're planted. What I don't want, Jeremy, is a student to go off to college and start off and think, I wonder what it would have been like if I would have been at the X school that denied me. Then you're already setting yourself up for disappointment. Go there. There was a reason why that fit happened. Grow where you're planted and just be the best student you can be wherever you land.
Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, Illinois. And we've got some tips from Lisa for sophomores as they prepare for some of these changes from the PSAT that we've been talking about at our website, hereandnow.org. Lisa, thanks so much as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The World Figure Skating Championships begin this week in Shanghai, and while American skaters like Ashley Wagner, Gracie Gold, Polina Edmonds, Jason Brown, Josh Farris do stand a chance of getting on the podium, they're not favored to win gold. Now, last month, 16-year-old Polina Edmonds did win the Four Continents Championships in South Korea, and Josh Farris came in second, skating to music from the movie Schindler's List, after shakily landing a quadruple jump.
Just about got there.
But in fact, it's been four seasons since an American man won a singles medal at the World Olympics, and it's been 8 years for the women. So what's it like to run the organization that has to balance a delicate art with fierce ambitions and a demand for big wins? Let's get the view from the top. Sam Akshur is president of the U.S. Figure Skating Association. He was a competitive skater and has long been a judge in skating competitions, including in the Sochi Olympics. Sam, welcome to Here Now.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be here.
Well, and you have been in office for just a year, but I was reading your statement of purpose, and you say part of your goal is ensuring that future generations stay in the sport so that you have people who grow up to be skaters. Is the profession in a lull right now?
Oh, I would disagree with that. I think we're actually on the upswing. We have some great young skaters in the first year of the new Olympic quad, so we're very excited about their prospects. And we also have other aspects of the sport like synchronized skating, where we're seeing great participation and skaters stay in the sport through that discipline as well.
Yeah, but you've had some pair skaters who have broken up. And as you say, Olympic quad, Olympic 4 years from now, so you got to be ready for that. And you also said recently that your governing body was focusing part of an $11.8 million athletic development budget on helping elite U.S. men get their technical game up. Is that a recognition that, you know, the men aren't doing the quads?
Well, absolutely. They're all doing the quads and the men. In the case of the world champion, three quads in one program. So it's very important that we step up the technical aspect of the sport and help them be competitive.
Well, and even as I said that to you, as a huge fan of the sport, I said to myself, don't do that. Don't be one of the people who puts all that attention on this, you know, the high emphasis on technical as opposed to artistic. Your thoughts on that as a former skater, is it a begrudging admission that other countries are focusing on the technical so the U.S. has to as well? Or, you know, I mean, it feels almost as if you could be the better skater artistically, and if you don't have that quad, it doesn't matter.
Well, I would say we're seeing competition from a lot of different countries that we haven't seen before even. They have focused on the technical side, but also on the artistic side as well. So if you watch top skaters, Yuzuru Hanyu from Japan or Dennis Ten from Kazakhstan, you see both great technical skill as well as the artistic skill. So the quad is really for the men almost a minimum technical requirement.
Yeah. And how do you feel about that, that the sport's gotten so technical?
Well, I think it's part of the evolution of the sport. You see athletes in all sports push the limits, and I think in skating we need to push it both technically and artistically as well. I think our skaters have the potential. When you look at Josh Farris and the quads that he's doing as well as artistry, he's upped his game and he's leading the way. And I think he's going to be very competitive with the top male skaters.
Well, so this is the professional. But as you say, the professional draws the others in, the kids who watch it and then dream of growing up to be a skater. But you also, in this statement of purpose, talked about a lot of ways that you want to expand the sport, including synchronized skating.
It's attracted a lot of skaters. There are a lot of college teams as well, and it's just one aspect of our sport where we see a lot of growth and opportunity to stay in that doesn't require a skater to be a top single skater.
Who knew? Who knew? You said this is the fastest growing discipline, or one of them, in skating.
One of them, absolutely.
Yeah. What skater inspired you?
Well, the skater that inspired me the most was probably John Mishapekovic, who was a national champion, fast skaters, strong, high jumps. But there have been many others. I competed against Scott Hamilton, who I still kid today that he inspired me. He inspired me to go to college, primarily by beating me so many times that I decided that I better go to college.
Yeah, but you ended up president of the U.S. Figure Skating Association.
Well, and he's an Olympic gold medalist, so.
There you go.
We both came out okay.
Samuel Oxer, president of the U.S. Figure Skating Association, as the world competition is right on the horizon. So, Sam, thanks for talking to us about it.
Oh, thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.